here with my new friend, Kevin Quinn.
So what BPD looks like, I mean, untreated and untreated are two very different things. Treated, it looks like any other human being. I suffered with the OCD, the tics got in my way, and I was embarrassed a lot of the time when they would creep their way into my daily life. And then around the age of 19, I started developing something different that seemed unrelated. Again, like having empathy for myself, realizing that like I could forgive myself for things that I thought I was at fault for when really I was just a victim of my own shitty circumstances. And that's the beautiful thing about BPD in general, right? It's one of the few mental disorders that can actually dissipate and, and you can go into remission, because bipolar disorder is lifelong, as we know. I mean, you treat it with medication, but it's always there.
This is Rooted Recovery Stories, and I'm Patrick Custer, your host. So glad that each and every one of you are here joining with us today on this episode. If you're watching, you might notice this is not our normal set. We're filming offsite in Los Angeles, and I'm here with my new friend, Kevin Quinn, actor, singer. It is so awesome to have you on the show today.
I'm excited to be here, man. I have a lot to say about this topic, so thank you for having me.
Yeah, I can't wait to flush it all out. Where, for so many of us, when we have all the tentacles of mental health that run through our lives, it's hard to say where it all began. Some of us have done more work than others to be able to identify, and sometimes it doesn't necessarily matter that we find the very beginning point. But I'm curious, when you talk about your story, what do you identify as like the beginning of when you noticed something being different in your psychology?
Yeah, it's true. It's like, I like the way you phrase that, like something different in my psychology, right? It's like almost a neurodivergency kind of thing, which I'm totally cool with that. I first noticed it around the age of 8, believe it or not. Specifically, this is kind of a crazy story. I still like don't know if it plays a part in how I like how my mental illness began. But when I was 8 years old, I had strep throat, and it was like just a normal episode of strep. But then like, this is according to my parents, who told me that like shortly after I had strep throat, I started developing tics, like physical motor tics, like shoulder twitches, blinking my eyes, clearing my throat, whatever it is, right? And my parents were like, that's odd. Like, what is that? And they took me to see a neurologist, and the neurologist mentioned something called PANDAS, P-A-N-D-A-S, which stands for like streptopical. I don't even know. Streptopical is the S or something.
My cousin has it.
Really?
It led to OCD.
Yes, because mine came with like an OCD diagnosis.
The dormant virus of strep can live forever and cause PANDAS. They now know, as of not too long ago, is directly correlated to OCD.
Yes, that's it. So basically, the whole idea was that like, it's possible that I could have had this strep infection, and it's, you know, because it's a virus, it spreads to the brain. So it's not just affecting the throat, right, like a normal strep infection. It's a more rare type of strep infection that affects the area called the basal ganglia. Mm. So it's possible that may be what caused it, because, you know, 20 years later, I now go to a psychiatrist and he tells me I have a basal ganglia issue.
Really?
So could that strep have like been the initiation of my mental health issues? I don't know. But all I know is I started getting these tics. It came with a diagnosis of OCD, where I felt like I had to wash my hands frequently, the typical OCD, that the stereotypical symptoms. And I really suffered with that. I suffered with the OCD, the tics got in my way. I had to have some special accommodations at school. I would have to hide them and suppress them to the best of my ability. And I was embarrassed a lot of the time when they would creep their way into my daily life and my peers would see. It was horrible for a time. But eventually the tics got better as I got older, almost like I grew out of it a little bit. And then around the age of 19, I started developing something different that seemed unrelated to the like Tourette OCD tick diagnosis, whatever that was. And I started having like emotional dysregulation is the best way I could describe it. Like, it was really terrible. I was acting impulsively. I would like drive, you know, 60 miles per hour in residential neighborhoods, like just horrible, reckless behavior.
So let me ask you, when you talk about emotional dysregulation, I think about two things. Were you having moments of your emotion, just feeling big emotions in and of themselves? And, or was it in response to like reactionary to other stimuli?
It was both.
Okay.
It was both. I mean, I had a problem regulating emotions where I would get so wrapped up in a thought in my head that it triggered this intense anger or sadness or just unhealthy emotions, and I would act out. Or it could be based on a trigger, like if someone honked at me on the road, I would just, a fit of rage, you know? And that's horrible behavior.
What did acting out typically look like for you?
Just like, it was different from time to time. Like a lot of times it was like, in my interpersonal relationships where I couldn't sustain relationships. I lost a lot of friends because I was like either disrespectful or mean. And you know, the ones that my real friends were the ones that stuck by me and knew that I was dealing with something and like encouraged me to get help. And then when I got better, they were able to see past what had happened and the scars in our relationship. But it affected a lot of my interpersonal relationships, to be honest. And, but all that to say, like, it was the best way I can describe what started happening around 19 and 20 was just like this impulsivity, this emotional dysregulation, dramatic, erratic behavior. And initially it was misdiagnosed as mania, and I was given a bipolar disorder diagnosis. So I was hospitalized at a point where when I was 19, I got into a fight, which I'm not.
Was the hospitalization the result of the fight?
Yes. And they sent me to UCLA Hospital, and I was put into UCLA Resnick Neuropsychiatric Hospital. And I spent a week there, and they evaluated me, the doctors, and the best guess for what they thought I was dealing with, the diagnosis I was given was bipolar disorder. So they put me on all these medications for bipolar disorder, antipsychotics, stuff like that. And the meds did help for a time, you know, because we were under the impression that if this was related to bipolar mania, you treat that with medication. That's the primary treatment. So I took these medications and I did see somewhat of a decrease in the emotional dysregulation, and I felt way more functional. And I was able to make amends in a lot of my relationships, and things started getting better from there. And I went probably another 4 years without having problems.
Were you med compliant that whole time?
I was.
Wow. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. I took it very seriously.
That also makes me... not to make light of it, but I feel like a lot of my friends with bipolar disorder would share in the jest with me that says that kind of leads to believe that wasn't necessarily what you were struggling with, because most people who struggle with bipolar disorder are not med compliant for the first, at least for the first little while, because you go through the bouts.
And I don't know why that is. I don't know if that has something to do with like mania and manic behavior, you know, kind of encourages them not to take their meds.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, people have explained to me, think about, because I'm in recovery from addiction and definitely did my fair share of speed when I was before I got sober. And, you know, people who I'm close to that struggle with bipolar mania have explained, like, here's the thing. If you think about the greatest that you felt, you know, like on whatever Coke binge or uppers, you know, mania feels a lot like that to people who are experiencing it. And if you take a med that brings you down to baseline, which is what a person should be feeling, it's not a negative feeling. It's just baseline, normal.
Exactly.
It's, well, that doesn't feel as good as
they're not used to it.
Well, you're not used to it, but not only that, but if you're, when you're in a manic episode, you're getting all this dopamine and all this stuff that's making your brain go ding, 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 you know? And so, of course, you know, it's, of course you think, oh, wait, but if I don't take this medication, I can feel like that. The thought is I should normally feel that sense of bliss that I feel during mania. And so I don't know, that is from the horse's mouth, if you will, how actual, you know, clients have explained this to me, you know, but
that can be dangerous, you know.
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
I learned a lot about bipolar disorder when I was told that I had it. Again, it was a misdiagnosis. So, but I still, at the time, we didn't know that. So I learned everything I could about it to try and better understand myself and improve. I mean, mania can be a very dangerous behavior. It may feel nice, but it's like, before you know it, you could be at the top of a building and feel like you could fly, you know? And that's just, it's very dangerous.
Yeah.
A lot of people die from suicide during manic episodes.
Yeah.
So I tried to be aware of that and understand that, which has encouraged me to be more med compliant, because on any chance that I was experiencing bipolar mania, I wanted to take my medication to avoid any bad things happening during an episode. However, I'll fast forward to the time that I was 22. Actually, no, around 20 and 21, I started getting side effects to the medications.
Mm.
I was taking this one medication called Seroquel, which is like a freaking tranquilizer, but I took it every night and thinking it was making me better. And for a time it was, but I started getting these side effects, and I think it was having some kind of a like psychotic effect on me when I would take it, because I felt like I would sometimes have distorted thinking, and I don't know why it wasn't working for me after 2 or 3 years, but it just wasn't. And then all of a sudden around 22, I had like a complete lapse in my brain function is the best way I can describe it. And I was on tour. I did this tour for 3 months, and I was on the road for 3 months. And it was a big tour. You know, I was playing arenas. I had to be on my game every night. And I would go back to the bus every night. I'd like stay up till 5 a.m. when all of my peers were asleep. And then I'd sleep in till 2, and then I'd wake up in like a depression. And but like this lapse in judgment happened when I returned home from tour to Los Angeles. Within 4 days, I started like getting these dissociative episodes. And I would like, I felt like I was losing my identity is the best way I can describe it, where I was not remembering certain things about who I was. I was not, like, for instance, I couldn't remember certain parts of myself. Like, do I value loyalty? Do I value compassion? Like, do I like to go on walks with my dog? Just like simple things that we take for granted as human beings that are part of our identity and our egos. Like, oh, I'm going to go on a walk with my dog because I like taking a walk with my dog. I couldn't make decisions because I was like, wait, do I like taking a walk with my dog? Should I go to bed right now? Like, it was just a weird state of like dissociation, and it's so difficult to describe, but that is the best way I could describe it, like a lapse in the part of my brain that was controlling ego and identity.
Hmm.
And I got to the point where I was so dysfunctional and not like able to get work done, I was like forgetting to eat. I lost a lot of weight. My girlfriend, who I cohabitate with, she was like, hey, I'm going to take you to the hospital. And so she drove me back to UCLA Psychiatric Hospital. And obviously they had records on me from 4 years prior. So I stayed another week there. They ran more tests. And then finally they said, okay, we think we know what's going on with you, but we can't treat it here. I was like, what do you mean? This is a hospital. Like, of course you can treat it here, right? And they said, no, this is a little more complex. We need to send you to residential treatment there's this place called Sierra Tucson in Tucson, Arizona that we think might be able to help you. I was like, oh, great. I just spent 3 months on the road for tour, and now I'm going to have to go for a month, like, you know, to Arizona and be away from my girlfriend, friends, and family for another month. That sucks. But I went, and, you know, before I went, they gave me the lowdown on BPD, saying, we think you were misdiagnosed with bipolar. We think it's actually a personality disorder. Here's a little bit more about what we think you're dealing with. It's called borderline personality disorder. You know, one of the core symptoms is a struggle with understanding your identity and a sense of self, which stems from this inner feeling of not knowing who you are as a core human being. So you like either latch on to certain identities, or you try to categorize your identity in certain ways if you feel that that gives you more of an identity because you're lacking it as a core, like really heavy stuff. I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? But I was like, wow, that's, I mean, it kind of hits the nail on the head. And so, you know, I went to Sierra Tucson and I did a month of treatment. And I, like, as I was going through this identity struggle, I got to Tucson and I was just like a shell of a man. Like, I looked in the mirror and I didn't recognize the person that was in front of me. It was the part of my brain that was controlling my identity was so fragmented that I would look in the mirror and feel like I might as well have been looking at John Smith, like some third person.
Wow.
It was really that, like, dissolved my identity is the best way I can describe it. So I'd look in the mirror and I'd like figure out, like, do I shave my head? Like, do I wear a hat? Do I like, how do I smile? Like, do I, you know, like really just not knowing anything about who I was. Really bizarre thing that's never happened to me, you know, before or since. So the first 12 days I was in treatment, I, again, was the shell of a man. I couldn't socialize with other human beings, other people in the program, because I didn't know anything about myself. So how am I going to relate to other people? And that's part of the disorder, is a struggle to relate to other people. But then I did group therapy. I did a process group. And this guy in process group, there were like maybe eight of us. And this one guy starts talking about his identity and like who he believed he was as a human being. And I just sat there listening. And then all of a sudden, as he was talking about his identity so confidently and so like assuredly, I started dissociating. Like I almost felt like I passed out. And my vision went blurry. And I was like listening to him in my subconscious with just like a black, blurry vision. And then he stopped talking and boom, just like that, my identity came flooding back to me. Like that one moment in my process group therapy, like fixed me. It was bizarre.
Wow.
And for the rest of the program, after that moment, after that group therapy, I felt amazing. I knew exactly who I was. I remember, oh, I'm Kevin. I, you know, typically shave my beard every 3 days. I, you know, like to wear t-shirts that look like this. I like my Nikes. Like I started remembering like parts of my identity. And it was awesome. It was like, wow, I'm back. And for the rest of treatment, I had a great time. I made a lot of friends. My interpersonal relationships improved. I was able to communicate and like become friends with people. I felt more confident about myself and relative in my relationships. And in that way, I got the treatment I needed to cure, or at least partially cure, the borderline personality disorder symptoms that I had been dealing with for so long.
Yeah.
So after that, I left the program, and it's hard, as you know, to go to from rehab back to the real world.
Absolutely.
That quickly. So you have to do an IOP program or like a PHP program. So I did an IOP program for another month and a half, and then a 13-month dialectical behavioral therapy program for 13 months after that. And by the time that was done, I'm proud to say, after all of that, the entire journey from UCLA Hospital to finishing my last therapy session of DBT almost a year and a half later, my BPD really is in somewhat of remission.
I love hearing that. But I think that one of the most beautiful things in all of this is that, it's not often that I hear of somebody with a BPD diagnosis that has followed through with, you know, we talk about how difficult it is for someone with borderline or with bipolar disorder to, you know, be med compliant and what have you. There's, I think a lot of times the difficulty with when a BPD diagnosis is given for the acceptance to be, for it to be accepted and then to follow through with, treatment for one reason or another there, you know, when you look through the DSM of the, I think it's 12, I don't know, correct me if you know the exactly what it is, but is it 10 or is it 12 of the like
personality disorders?
The traits that in order to be diagnosable, yeah, you have to have five of the eight
criteria.
Okay. Wow. I had all the names. all the
That's right.
Sure. But yeah,
I think so, I could be wrong.
Okay. So five of the eight. And
so here's the interesting thing, mm-hmm. actually, while you mentioned that, it should be noted that there were times where I didn't meet all of the criteria.
Really?
Yes. And yet I was still given a working diagnosis of BPD, and it is the closest diagnosis to what I deal with. But it goes to say that you can't fit human psychology into one box.
Right.
Someone can still be dealing with something that is along the lines of this diagnosis, but mm-hmm. it may not look exactly how it's supposed to be outlined in the DSM.
Mm-hmm.
Because human psychology is complex. You yeah. can't fit these things into a simple box of, oh, here's the five criteria. If you don't meet it, you don't have it. It doesn't right. work like that.
Right.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
Could your diagnosis not have been that? Are they just saying, is PANDAS considered, if that is indeed correct, which I guess they really don't know for sure, but would that be the cause and then BPD was the result? Or could you possibly really just have PANDAS? Is that a diagnosis in and of itself?
I think it's possible that that the BPD is a result of the basal ganglia issue in my brain, and the basal ganglia issue is a result of possibly this PANDAS thing or the Tourette syndrome, OCD, whatever you might have it. Like, it's all the same part of the brain, in my opinion, that's the part of the brain that is being affected through all of this.
Yeah.
Let me feed you guys back this information so that you have it. PANDAS is short for pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorders associated with streptococcal infections.
Wow.
So it says a child may be diagnosed with PANDAS when obsessive compulsive disorder like OCD, tic disorder, or both suddenly appear following a streptococcal or strep infection, such as strep throat or scarlet fever. The symptoms are usually dramatic, happen overnight and out of the blue, and can include motor or vocal tics or both, obsessions, compulsions, or both. And in addition to these symptoms, child may become moody or irritable, experience anxiety attacks, show concerns about separating from parents or loved ones, and can develop a very uncharacteristic and complex relationship with food.
That's amazing. I mean, it sounds a lot like what I was dealing with when I was younger. I do think PANDAS is pretty close, and I think it's likely that this is what caused the myriad of my problems and that it stems back to that part of my childhood.
I'm curious to know as well, because, I mean, clearly that it was another one of the personality disorders are all typically traced back to some type of like trauma base.
Yeah.
Borderline is connected to attachment.
Mm-hmm.
So where have you done work around trying to find mm-hmm. where is the how did the attachment piece play out for you? Was mm-hmm. there something early on that happened that gave you any type of insecurity around not having your needs met or being.
Yeah, there was. I do have this fear of abandonment that is typical with those struggling with BPD and one of the hallmarks of the disorder. Mm-hmm. And I was able to identify that through therapy, that this fear does exist for me. For me, I don't know exactly where it comes from. But it's there, and I don't know why it's there. There is an attachment issue as well, where I tend to attach myself or become very quickly attached. I've done it in a lot of relationships. I've moved very quickly with girlfriends in the past where I sort of attached myself onto them, and I struggled in romantic relationships a lot. I've done it with family members, you know, where like in times of stress or anxiety, I attach myself to a parent as a source of comfort and feel like I get part of my identity from them if I'm struggling with who I am in the moment. So it's a very complex thing, you know, and it presents itself in all kinds of my relationships and my friendships, but nonetheless, it is part of the disorder, and I think it's tied to the fear of abandonment. But yeah, attachment's always been an issue for me.
Have you ever talked to your parents about like, hey, did I have attachment issues before this incident with strep? Because what Patrick asked you, it's interesting to answer it this way. He said, do you have an instance, can you trace back like an attachment issue or what may have caused that? Well, you did agree that you have an attachment issue, but it sounds like you don't know the source.
I don't. I really don't. And I hope
you don't remember the first, like when it first showed up. You don't remember like a specific incident where.
I don't.
Really?
I really hope that's something I can uncover in therapy, but I just, at this point in my healing recovery journey, I don't know where it comes from.
The pandas thing fits. It may mean that you didn't have one.
Maybe not.
That's what's so confusing about it, is because it presents like it's BPD, but it doesn't necessarily, like a lot of people can trace it back to like, oh yeah, my mom did, you know, my mom was not present. My mom was addicted to something, or not present when I was crying. And although you have attachment issues, you may never be able to uncover that source if, in fact, it did start from strep.
That's a really astute observation. I mean, yeah, like with attachment, like, let me just say this. Like with BPD, there is this tendency for it to be a result of like abuse, you know, either abuse or like invalidation.
Yeah.
Where a parent invalidated you and made you think that you couldn't trust your own feelings or how you feel about yourself. That I can understand how someone might get BPD from a prolonged exposure to an environment like that. I never had that. Mm-hmm. I had very loving parents. I didn't have a traumatic childhood. I did some neuropsych testing through my healing journey, and the best guess that the neuropsych doctor said was like, it's possible that you just might have had difficulty relating to others as a child because of your genetic makeup and not because of any environmental or traumatic like circumstance.
Wow. Very interesting.
Could be a neurodivergent thing.
Right.
But I don't think there is like a particular instance where the attachment issues came from, unless it were a genetic thing like the strep or that part of my brain just being neurodivergent.
Right. Well, it is fascinating because, and I mean, like, do you have to have it? It doesn't necessarily matter. I mean, like the thread is woven regardless, because you're identifying the like that hallmark of the fear of abandonment. And that's something that I think that everyone that struggles with or has, is in recovery from this diagnosis shares in common, you know, and gosh, when I think about looking at the way how life gets stolen from people with BPD, I think exactly what you're talking about, relationships suffer, it's impossible to make, you know, keep and maintain them. And then because of that, you have a distorted sense of self. And so I'm curious, like, what has, and I'm such a big fan of it, because before Mark, thank God for Marsha Linehan, you know, because before she came along, we literally had no effective treatment for PPD.
Yeah. And now it's to the point where people can actually go in remission.
Yeah.
Like, that's the great thing. I mean, it sucks.
Because you take those tools forward with you, though.
Yes.
Because do you not use your DBT skills today?
I go through life with it.
Exactly. So it's not like you are fixed and you're in remission and you don't do anything to deal with your stuff.
Yeah.
You've got tools that you utilize.
I do.
And so let's talk a little bit about that. When, you know, you started doing the dialectical, DBT standing for dialectical behavioral therapy. Can you just, for all intents and purposes, I don't know anything about DBT. What is it? What did you learn about it? And how do you use it to help you?
Yeah. Oh, it's helped me immensely. I mean, again, I attribute my partial remission to it. And that's the beautiful thing about BPD in general, right? Like, if you do utilize the modalities of treatment and the therapies, it's one of the few mental disorders that can actually dissipate and you can go into remission, because bipolar disorder is lifelong, as we know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you treat it with medication, but it's always there. That's not the case with BPD. If you treat it, it tends to go away. And from my understanding, after 12 years, 99% of people, their symptoms are completely gone. And it's something like after the first year, 78% of people have their symptoms completely gone. So the longer that time goes after treatment, the more likely it is to disappear over time, which is great.
Yeah.
But for DBT, I mean, the best way I can describe DBT is cognitive behavioral therapy with Zen Buddhism.
Okay.
It's CBT with Zen Buddhism in a nutshell. But I can give you examples of like certain skills that I use. Mindfulness is the biggest one. It is they push it on you the most out of any of the other modalities in the treatment. And that includes just like getting out of your head, recognizing your surroundings. There are these skills called observe, describe, and participate, where I can observe like, oh, I'm in a house right now and I'm participating in a podcast. There's a camera right there. I'm participating by speaking to you and engaging in our conversation. Observe, describe, participate, observe. Like it's
so kind you of just a, described and then you, yeah, you described, yeah, you observed, described, observe, and you participate, and then you're participating by observing, being present and talking to me.
Exactly.
But why? Why are you going to utilize those skills?
Because people, I mean, for me personally, like, for people with BPD who deal with emotional dysregulation, their minds are always racing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really hard not to get wrapped up in those thoughts. And if you can consciously practice bringing yourself out of it and into the real world, you'll see that more often than not in this moment, you're fine. Mm-hmm. You're safe. You're at peace. You know, like the emotions, the crazy anger or sadness or depression, those big emotions don't exist outside of your head. So mindfulness is the biggest part of DBT. And then there are other skills like interpersonal effectiveness. There's this skill called Dear Man and then Give Fast. They're acronyms, but they're easy to remember. And that just means that when I talk to you, I use a gentle manner.
What does Dear Man stand for? Do you remember?
I think Dear Man stands for describe, express, assert, reinforce, mindful, appear, negotiate, I think.
Okay. And so when we talk about all of that put together, an example would be...
Yeah, it's basically what I just said, which is like, I use a calm and gentle, easy manner when I speak to you. Uh-huh. I'm listening to what you're saying and I'm not usurping the conversation. Using interpersonal effectiveness to facilitate a healthy interpersonal relationship, essentially. That's another skill. Other times with distorted thinking, there's a skill called check the facts. And if a distorted thought comes up, you are able to identify it as potentially distorted and you can validate whether or not it is distorted by asking, is that a fact? And using logic to assess whether or not that is a fact. And if it doesn't add up to be a fact through logic. It's a distorted thought. What's another skill? There's a skill called wise mind, which is, if you can imagine, a Venn diagram. And in the middle is wise mind, which is the healthiest mind. And then on one side is emotional mind, and the other is logic mind. That those two, there is a time and place for each of those two minds to be used. But a lot of times emotional mind, leading a life of emotional mind, will lead to emotional dysregulation. Mm-hmm. And leading a life of only logic mind will lead to unfulfilled emotional satisfaction and life, and possibly depression. So if you can combine the two and combine your emotional mind with logic to say, I have all these like big feelings and you know, intense happiness or depression or sadness that just are overwhelming. But if I can sort of put logic to it and say, I'm going to like, you know, applying a technique called acceptance and change, which is another pillar of DBT. Like I'm going to, if I'm feeling intense sadness, I'm going to use logic and therefore my wise mind to turn it around by focusing on doing something that brings me intense joy. There's another skill called distraction. It could be just turning on the TV and distracting yourself from your thoughts for a period of time, or going out and gardening or something like that and engaging in a task. You could listen to music really loud if you're feeling very angry, to sort of have a healthy outlet. I mean, there's a lot of people, you'd be surprised, a lot of people have actually taken DBT, especially in the entertainment industry too. Like I know Pete Davidson's done it with his BPD, and Selena Gomez for her bipolar.
It's effective. They found it's effective for so much more than just borderline.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just wanted to touch on one of the things. So again, one of the hallmarks of borderline personality disorder is also black and white thinking.
Oh, that's
so, you know, you talk about the emotional mind and the logical mind, how easy it is to fall into one or the other and thinking that the only choice you have in that moment is to live slash and or believe that this world is the only one, and you completely forget about the other one.
I lived my life for years not knowing it in black and white. I lived thinking that things could only be going really great for me or really shitty, or I could really like this person and love them, they're the best thing that ever happened since sliced bread, or I really hate their guts. And that's not a healthy way of living.
No,
but it applies to all aspects of life, this black and white thinking. And so the DBT modality really strives to combine two worlds and live in this gray area. It's why also acceptance and change is such a big idea, which is if you're feeling a certain way, like intensely sad, you counteract it with intense joy and find yourself, the result is something in the middle gray area.
You said you lost friendships. Many people don't know what BPD looks like. Even though they might have someone in their life that's either undiagnosed or diagnosed, they just don't know about the diagnosis. So if you were to give an example from day to day, right? Like what can you walk us through how your relationships and your emotions looked different, especially compared to how they look today in a state of remission and healing?
Yeah. So what BPD looks like, I mean, untreated and untreated are two very different things. Treated, it looks like any other human being.
Right.
You know, just a normal person like me, you know. But that wasn't always the case for me when I was untreated. Untreated, it looks a lot like, you know, screaming at people, yelling at people, erratic behavior, impulsivity. I mean, I remember one time I was so impulsive, I got into a fight with a loved one in Palm Springs at like 3 a.m. And I was so upset that I decided to drive all the way back to LA in a fit and do the 3-hour drive at 3 a.m. just because I was feeling impulsive and rageful.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
it's ridiculous, you know, like, but that's the thing. It's like, it could look like impulsivity. It is strained interpersonal relationships. It could look like black and white thinking. If you're in a conversation with someone struggling with BPD, they may love you one second, then be really cold to you the next, because their opinions of you are black and white at times and constantly shifting, or it's a reflection of themselves in that their opinions about themselves and who they are is constantly shifting.
Well, and so the grouping of the black and white, you've got the positive, the people that are good, or the toxic, the black, how much of that interchangeable did you see? In my own experience, I didn't see a lot, or I haven't seen a lot in active BPD of people going from the, like, once you're written off, you're kind of written off.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, God, I guess what I'm asking is, like, what did that look like for you? I mean, was that the case for you? Were you like ending relationships? Were you going back to them at all? Or
it was both.
Really?
I was being written off, but I was also writing people off, because in the process of me having this black and white thinking, if I loved someone and they were my best friend one second, and then suddenly something happened and that opinion shifted, I would like cut contact. Mm. And some of them I never reached out to again. And then some of them, if my opinion of them changed again, where I love them all over again and they're the best thing since sliced bread, then I reach out again. But at that point, they may not want anything to do with me. Mm. So it was a little bit of both. It's like sometimes I would cut off relationships. Sometimes people would cut off relationships with me because they probably knew something was up and just couldn't handle the instability and stress that a relationship with me brought. Mm-hmm. I really struggled in my family life, my romantic relationships. People with BPD just want to be loved like everyone else. And so it was hard to like be dating, not knowing what was going on with me, and I couldn't hold relationships.
Talking about the interpersonal and the side of relationships, one of my favorite explanations that I was given at one point, and I reference this all the time when talking about it, to describe the essence of what BPD can look like in relationship dynamic is it's a tennis match. And let's just say you and I are, you would be, let's just say you are the person with borderline personality disorder. I'm not. We're playing tennis and our producer is the referee. And the person that's got active BPD, like I score fairly on you, and Aaron calls the shot that I got the score, and this is so devastating to you, and you have such a big emotional reaction that you're upset not only at me but also Aaron for calling the shot, because you're losing the game and you don't understand why we're also not just as upset with you that this game is lost, and that the emotion is so big for you that if we aren't there with you in the same space, acknowledging and feeling how devastating this emotion is for you, there's no room for you to see that someone else is experiencing joy in that same time, and it's just a game.
Yeah. That's a great way to describe it, actually.
It's the best way I've ever had somebody explain that to me, because it's not demonizing. That there's so much that you can hear about BPD that makes it sound like it is taking the humanity away from an individual that suffers with BPD. But the fact of the matter is you've got a real human being there that is experiencing reality in such a different way, and their emotions in such a different way, that the reaction is what it is. And it makes it impossible to share any type of emotional situation with others, because yours is always going to win out over mine.
Yeah. Or at least to me.
To you. Right. And so when my interest in this part is asking you, what helped you move from that space where your emotions were the primary factor in relationship. And it became equal when, do you know what I mean?
I do. I think what really helped me is that as I learned and became more self-aware through my treatment and recovery journey, I started to have more empathy for myself. And I think that in return led to more empathy for other people and seeing how I may have hurt them or how, you know, again, like having empathy for myself, realizing that like I could forgive myself for things that I thought I was at fault for when really I was just a victim of my own shitty circumstances. So I think empathy had a big part in that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So what, today, I guess the transition, you know, like you said, you moved into a bigger place of empathy, utilizing more skills. Was healing linear for you, or did it kind of go like this, like up and down as, as you know, you were going into a place of remission?
It was mostly linear.
Really?
Yeah, it was. There were dips of like moments where I like forgot to use my skills and I had like a moment, but for the most part, as time goes on, I continue to improve. Which is surprising because you'd expect it to not be so linear.
Right.
And I know for a lot of people it's not.
It's not.
However, that's just my subjective journey.
Yeah.
I also think it's really great because I have such a great support network, of people who love me, and I choose to live a healthy lifestyle. I don't drink because that tends to exacerbate emotional dysregulation when, you know, alcohol affects my state of mind. So I haven't had a drink in over 4 years. And I'm proud of that. And what else? You know, my parents are super supportive. My therapist is supportive. My psychiatrist is supportive. I have a job and I continue to work on a career and live a productive life of not just like choosing to mope because living with BPD is hard, and it is hard. But I don't choose to sleep in every day for 18 hours out of depression. I choose to use opposite action and get, that's another skill, opposite action, get out of bed, do something productive with my days every day. And it leads to a very fulfilling, productive life. And I have done a lot of great things in my life thus far. You know, I signed a record deal when I was 21. I have get to work as an actor in a really exciting industry. I started a podcast. You know, it's not like I'm...
You've done a... Okay, so let's talk about that a little bit. You've done a hell of a lot, and it's all been through... correct me if I'm wrong. It's been through this period of time that we're talking about. No?
It has been, which is... And I appreciate you saying that. It's kind of crazy to me because I feel like I shouldn't have been able to do all that while I was dealing with this. But I think it is a testament to my character, which is deep down, like even if I was struggling with this thing without a name at the time, I still wanted to make something of myself in my life because I knew I was capable. And I knew that I could lead a fulfilling, successful life, and not just my career, like my personal relationships as well. Like even now I've been with my girlfriend of 4 years, and oh man, like she's the best thing that's ever happened to me. And she's so supportive of the BPD stuff. Like she knows so much about it at this point. She flew out with me to Tucson to drop me off at rehab just out of the goodness of her heart. She knows about the identity issues I have. If I tell her I'm like dissociating or having an issue, she'll take my hand and squeeze it. Like, damn, I couldn't ask for a better partner, you know? And I think that's another thing, like those who are dealing with BPD, it's like they can have successful relationships as well. And it just takes finding the right person who is understanding and who can support them in their journey of recovery and see them for who they are beyond just the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And there were people that I was with who didn't see beyond it. Mm-hmm. And the ones who can't are the keepers. And that's the same thing with my friends, right? Like the friends who I could call at like 3 a.m. And there were friends that I call at 3 a.m, you know, like in tears over the phone, like, you got to help me, man. And they were there and they've stuck with me and we've had our ups and downs, but they know I deal with this thing and they're always going to be there because they love me, you know? And, so I'm blessed in a lot of ways.
What is the, you know, you just talked about people who are supportive to you. If you were to describe and give advice to someone who is a support system for someone with BPD, what would be that advice that you would give them is how they can best show up in that person's life?
I would encourage them to be very attuned to their partner's feelings, their disposition, because people with BPD tend to have very active minds and they may not always express everything that they're dealing with because it's a lot. So if their partner can pick up on their energy or at least be attuned to like, oh, like my partner seems a bit anxious right now, I'm gonna, you know, pat their back and or rub their back and be there to support them and just little actions like that. Or my partner seems upset, I'm going to give them space. Stuff like that, you know. For those who are not being treated for BPD, I think the best thing that a partner or a loved one or a family member can do is simply be aware of what the other person is going through and have empathy for them. And it's really hard to encourage someone suffering from BPD, especially if they don't know it, to like go get treatment or like go to therapy. And you can't just say, hey, you should go to therapy, because then it sounds like kind of passive aggressive or like they've got a problem. And if they don't necessarily, if they haven't accepted that they have a problem yet, they're not going to take to that very kindly. So I think going back to this dear man skill, maybe there's a way for partners and loved ones to say, hey, you know, I noticed like you've been feeling, it seems like you've been feeling upset lately or down in the dumps. Would you ever be interested in talking to someone about it? You know, or is there anything I can do to help? And phrase it in a very gentle manner that you're genuinely concerned for them. Mm-hmm. And then if they let you, you know, you can participate in you know, hooking them up with a therapist or a treatment program. Yeah. But it's really hard. I know people who struggle with BPD who haven't yet accepted
right
that they have this. And for me, it's different because I've gone through the journey. I've accepted. I live a healthy life post-treatment. But there are people out there who I see struggle with the exact same thing that I struggled with before I got treated. And I want so badly to just like send them off to Sierra Tucson, right? And say, you will thank me. But I can't. Mm-hmm. Because the only one who can do that is them.
Right.
And that's really hard because I also see how it affects their loved ones. You know, if this is like a friend or a family member, so whatever, like, then I see how this affects other people in my mm-hmm. circle, you know? So it's just really hard.
It takes what it takes for, I mean, I don't hate to do this because it just, it is what it is. I mean, really with everything under the behavioral health umbrella, in order to get help, we don't, that age old saying of like, we don't change until the pain of staying the same hurts worse than the pain of change. So that's basically saying until the bottom, you don't hit your bottom, that makes you do something different until it hurts too bad to stay the same. Mm-hmm. And so those consequences being great enough look different for everybody. Yeah. Losing relationships, how many are enough?
Oh,
yep. The self-defeating, the being tired of, you know, what's going on inside your own brain, how yeah. much is enough? And it's so different for everybody. So God, thank you so much for opening up about all of this with us. I think one of the most impactful things that we can get to, that I always love to take this journey at the end, is unpacking, for that person that I think this especially for that person who is listening, going, I've known something's off with me. And so much of what Kevin's been talking about today is ringing true, but they would have never been open for somebody else saying these things to them. If they're wondering and curious about, you know, is this me? Do I need to check this out? What would you say to the person that's struggling today?
Easy answer. Go get a professional opinion. And I know it's hard to take that first step, but that's really the only step you need to take. Because if you're talking to a licensed professional or someone who specializes, like a therapist, a psychiatrist, they will be able to help you. And all it takes is that first step, and it may be scary, but once you do it, you'll see it wasn't that bad. And then you might just get the help that you need.
Yeah.
That would be my advice.
So for, you know, we've talked about the pandas, we talked about the borderline personality disorder. And honestly, for both of those, it affects the whole family. It's not just the person and the, you know, all the people around them. So for the support system, you know, is there any advice that you would give to them?
Yeah, I think especially for parents, because, you know, children are equally susceptible to mental health disorders as, you know, we adults. And a lot of these sort of pediatric disorders like PANDAS or even Lyme disease, something like that. I mean, I think it's important for parents to not be afraid to be their own advocates. I mean, it's from my understanding that diagnosing something like that can take on average like five medical professionals. So, I mean, don't be afraid to be your own advocate and say to your treatment team or your doctor, like, hey, can you test my child for this? Can you test my child for that? This is what happened. He had strep. I've noticed he has tics, whatever it is, right? But not being afraid to be your own advocate, because you are essentially part of the treatment team as well, right? Because you have to live with the sufferer firsthand, and your treatment team wants to help you and you want to help your child. So just advocate, be a self-advocate.
I think that's really good advice, no matter what you're talking about when in the medical field, because whether you're a parent, whether you're the person, the patient, that was my, I mean, not to get fully into my story, but I lived that story out medically as well. And I mean, if I had taken the answer that kept getting given to me, I wouldn't be here today, because I kept getting misdiagnosed. I full-heartedly believe that our medical system is full of passionate and caring professionals that want to help and heal, but they can't see everything. I mean, even with all the technology and equipment and information that we have, they can't see everything inside of us at all times. And I think that it's I heard this one time and it's always stuck with me. I think it was my primary care provider who said that one of the best things that helps to inform providers, whether they're talking about behavioral health, any type of medical provider, inform best practice decision-making is the fact that the squeakiest wheel will get the most grease, meaning the thing that persists will give the most information, the best information to the provider to make the best decision. And it's called practice for a reason, because it's constantly being practiced. So being persistent about what is going on, I think, is so key. No matter if you're the person or you're the parent.
Yeah.
So, and it is just so great to hear. Like, your story is one of just such encouragement. And I have to say, I think that it's so much hope, because, you are so young and so successful, and high functioning in remission with BPD. It's possible.
I appreciate that. Yeah, it's definitely possible. And I hope, you know, to our listeners, like, that it serves as proof that there is hope beyond, you know, a mental health disorder. And I hope it encourages them that, like, you know, you can be just like me and high functioning and successful post-treatment and have a career and have successful relationships. You know, I just hope that it serves as encouragement to them.
Absolutely. Kevin Quinn. Incredible. Yeah. Thanks, you so much. With that, I'm going to close out reminding you how I always do to remember that it's never too late to start loving yourself, and you're always only ever one decision away from a completely different life.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.